if the vaccine program does change or we need to adapt our software or more people sign up to use the vaccine booking software, it's very, very hard to like say no to that or turn away from it, right? So I've definitely felt, you know, both the pressure myself and then felt awful for almost having put like the team through it in a sense. I don't think any of us quite realized the Herculean effort that would be required over such a long time to actually deliver it.
Ever wonder how the e-commerce brands you admire know just the right messages to send to the right people at the right time? Guess what? It's not experience. They have the right data and the right tools. They have Klaviyo. Klaviyo helps brands easily create personalized multi-channel marketing campaigns using your most powerful asset, your customer data. Klaviyo integrates with all leading e-commerce platforms, helping you use your customer data in real time to send more relevant email and SMS automations. Klaviyo's data-driven marketing platform is sophisticated enough to power those legendary campaigns from the brands you admire, but they made it simple, easy, and fast enough for anyone to use. Building a marketing campaign is drag and drop easy. To get started with a free trial of Klaviyo, visit klaviyo.com/secretleaders. That's klaviyo.com/secretleaders. Of the six UK unicorns who have exited, can you guess what they all have in common? They've all been advised by our latest partner, Deloitte. And there's good reason for that. I know the joy and pain that comes with scaling a company fast. You need to focus on growth, your team, and customers, but often your attention is taken away by must-dos in areas like finance and compliance. I'm talking about headaches, like making sure you're charging VAT correctly on a new product, or your intellectual property is watertight, or having the right corporate structure for international expansion. These are complicated areas that you're really not trying to innovate in. So you need a partner like Deloitte who knows them inside out so you don't screw them up and you get more time and increase your chances of success. So whether you're an early stage startup or an international scale up, check out Deloitte's high growth team to help find the right answers faster. Search Deloitte Private to find out more. Welcome to Secret Leaders, the UK startup podcast from Infamous Media. I'm Dan Murray-Serta, and this is the show where we bring you insights and stories from the UK's most impactful founders. Today, I'm really excited to be speaking with Lawrence Bargery, the CTO and co-founder of AcuRex, a health tech startup that's been on the front line of the fight against COVID. AcuRex helps healthcare teams communicate with their patients through features like text messaging and video calling. Their software has exploded since COVID, with an astonishing 99% of GP surgeries using their software. And if you've booked a COVID jab, there's a good chance you've used their technology. Now, in this conversation, Lawrence takes us through the company's journey from solving the wrong problems to its current place as a linchpin in the UK's vaccine rollout program. And yes, it's been as rapid and challenging as you'd think. But first, back to the start, when Lawrence was a fresh-faced software engineer participating in the Entrepreneur First incubator and being introduced to potential co-founders.
This is where AcuRex came from. Yeah, I met Jacob sort of a week into the program, so I'd spent a week with sort of another co-founder and then saw that he was still looking for someone and was very, very much interested in what he was proposing at the time. Back then, it was something completely different. So we started off looking at antibiotic resistance. So huge problem, right? Like lots of people know about it, that bacteria are becoming more resistant to the antibiotics we use because generally we overuse them. And like super similar problem to climate change, massive externality, individual, you know, interaction. Dan, you go to the doctor. They are really short in time. It might be viral, might be bacterial cough. You get a prescription in that moment. Doesn't actually matter too much. But net, if that keeps happening, obviously overall, we all sort of like suffer. So we were looking to see if we could try and improve those prescribing decisions, make essentially decision support software, and also provide information to patients about this is why you haven't been given an antibiotic today. We spent the first year and a half of the company basically on this idea. So, you know, we built out the software. We built out a really good but small team. We were only sort of six or seven people. And ultimately, we plugged away at that for, you know, a really good amount of time. I wouldn't say we sort of felt like we gave up easily. We were, you know, going to practices, trying to install, trying to get usage. But back then, a good day was when we hit double digits sort of usage of the tool, and we'd celebrate 10 a day. And I think around sort of October time, 2017, we just decided this just isn't working. Ultimately, it's a massive problem, but the market's not there. There aren't the right either carrot or stick to change people's behaviour. And so we needed to focus on something else.
What did you do next then?
We got really interested, actually, originally by the idea of skill mix. So we knew there was this problem of sort of shortage of GPs, that, you know, nurse practitioners and paramedics were fantastic what they do and could actually see a sort of lot of ailments. So we got quite interested by that idea and of those people, so paramedics and nurses, being able to see more patients and what software they need. But we also really realized we just don't know enough about healthcare or how GPs work. We needed to do more user research. So we had this idea to do something super unscalable. I think it came from Jacob and myself reading about the early days of Airbnb. And I think they like went round and took the photos themselves of like the listings. And we thought, let's go to two GP practices and just get under their skin and almost do sort of bespoke consulting projects, right, for those practices for free. Turned out two was too many, so we went down to one. And we basically drove to Oxford every single day to this practice called Manor Surgery. And every single day, three or four members of the team went there. We got up really early, got there for sort of surgery opening and phone lines opening for 8 o'clock. And we just did everything we could to try and get under the skin of general practice. And we knew, you know, this was one surgery, didn't represent every single practice in the country, but just by seeing things rather than even just talking to people, I think we soaked up so much healthcare context. You know, we even did things like buying headphone splitters so we could listen to what was going on in reception at the same time as them seeing calls. And we could observe, you know, seeing things like they're having to spin around on chairs with one phone, you know, between their ear while using the software. And you suddenly realize, actually, the software you're building is so secondary to all these other things you're going on. You know, the way we might interact with software, we're like in front of our computer, properly sat there and focused. And we started to build up just so many more ideas of things we could do. And actually, that was sort of a 3-month period we did that from up till sort of Christmas time 2017. And then almost what became our biggest problem was, what do we even go after? Because there were just so many things we thought we can add value there, or we can do something better there. And whilst we did think that the skill mix idea could be really powerful, ultimately, we started to feel like, well, biggest problem is going to be both behavior change, but also that you might need to have practices actually hire a bunch more nurses and paramedics to do this. And is it just going to be scalable enough? And that's where this idea came from, really, beginning of the year 2018, of what's something super simple we can do that's going to be really powerful and applicable to so many of the problems in general practice or in healthcare. And ultimately, that was communication. That was, can we get messages to patients more easily?
So you basically went from having the solution and trying to figure out if it really was a problem people had to just going in and learning what the problems were and then starting afresh, right? So what was V1 of the Acurx product then?
So we, interestingly, when we actually were doing the antibiotic software, we had part of it, which was text messaging. So we had this idea that we were like, patients love leaving with a thing. It's why, like, giving someone a prescription, it sort of signals the end of your consultation, right? So back then in the antibiotic software, we did have a text messaging component. We thought, instead of leaving it with a prescription, if you're not prescribed, you can leave with a text message with information. So we thought, well, we'll take that text messaging component we had in the antibiotic software and we'll just make it so that anyone can use it in the GP surgery for any use case. So V1 was basically this small floating toolbar where you clicked one button, it automatically took the patient context because we integrated with the sort of medical record system. It brought up a user interface where it already pre-filled sort of patient name, the patient's phone number if it was in their record. You've got your text box, fill it in, hey Dan, your prescription's ready to collect, and you hit send, and it goes back into the patient's record and arrives on your phone. And that was it. It couldn't have been more simple, and that's what we were aiming for, was that the use case, and I guess the moment of like value to the user where they realize, hey, this has saved me time. We wanted that to be as short as possible. We'd call it like the aha moment where they get it, that this has just saved 5 minutes.
So how did you actually get traction with GPs? So obviously you've gone and you've identified that this is a thing and you've started to see that this is going to be good, but that's very different
as you know, from, and you've already experienced, from actually getting people interested in taking this on board and scaling it. And I guess, how receptive were they as an audience that you're selling into? You know, they, is it easier than it seems because not many people do, or what's the case?
Yeah, so I mean, in terms of how it played out for us. So yeah, you're very right. Obviously, we had this idea, and we built this SMS sort of tool, but we still only had a couple of practices that were using us from the antibiotic days really then. And so, you know, we're still talking sort of tens of practices, and obviously we really wanted to grow this. So how it started was we made there's a website builder called Wix. We basically sent out leaflets across the country. So we made a sort of leaflet saying, hey, we've got this great SMS tool. It's going to save you loads of time. And I think we'd seen from like one of these marketing playbooks, if you make it individualized, you might get a bit more uptake. So we wrote handwritten post-it notes for the surgery in every single one. And we sent out 1,000 flyers and sat there patiently waiting for anyone's going to pick up the phone.
Is that you sent out 1,000 flyers and 1,000 post-it notes individualized, or it was a bunch of flyers, like 10 to 50 per GP practice and the same post-it?
I think we did a sort of leaflets to each practice, but every single one contained a post-it note. So we had these, you know, like team bonding sessions where we'll get some pizza. You got a list of names, a pen, and you're going to write a lot of post-it notes saying, dear Dan, we think this software would be great for you. Thanks, Lawrence. And a couple of those seeds landed. We were lucky enough that a couple of people opened that and thought, this looks interesting. I'll give them a call. And so we used this website builder Wix to, for each practice that were keen, spin up a sort of like self-service page. We didn't have a proper self-service flow that anyone could land on. So each time we were spinning up a little mini website for like, you know, Dan's practice. Then we sent them to that page that was like individualized self-service flow. And we tried to get them to go through it and install the software themselves. But obviously, you know, a couple of the early ones, you're on the phone too, seeing what problems they hit, etc. And those are really our first sort of like seeds. And from very early on, I think we thought that, or we had strong conviction that if those practices loved the software and would tell other people about it, that would be one of the strongest ways for us to grow ultimately. And so from quite early into 2018, we worked on just adding some simple features which would try and incentivize people to refer the software to others. And so while we did a few more of those leaflets, ultimately, a lot of our growth during that year was essentially organic growth. We were incredibly lucky that, yeah, people actually did tell others about it because they felt it was really saving them time.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And I guess, you know, this is the thing, right? You're sort of hustling for some growth. And I know that, you know, you put a lot of energy and effort into personalizing the experience for GPs and stuff. But obviously, the demand for a product like yours pre something like COVID and then post COVID, where you've absolutely exploded, very different. So before we get into the quite exciting way that you've actually basically helped the whole of the UK, you know, get on track, what was your business like pre COVID? What did AccuRx actually look like?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess if we go back sort of just before the pandemic hit, so sort of early 2019, I guess we're talking about, sorry, early 2020, we were around 25 people, so still pretty small. We just celebrated hitting 50% of GPs in the country using us, or GPs in England using us. So still been really focused on growth as a company. And that had been, you know, one of our main sort of metrics was adoption, trying to still spread the word and get as many GPs using us as possible. And we just started to enter the realm of sort of asynchronous two-way communication. So we're really strong believers that asynchronous communication is going to play a vital role in the sort of future of medicine. There's always going to be, you know, a place for sort of face-to-face and synchronous communication, but the two-way, like the way in lots of the rest of our lives, I can just WhatsApp you, you don't have to reply immediately. That's going to play a big part in the future. And so we've taken basically some technology that we'd built again during the antibiotic days, which was sort of this concept of a patient filling out a survey. And we turned that into a remote asthma survey. So, you know, every year GP practices need to check in on how their asthmatics are doing. They're incentivized to do so. We tried to take the really fundamental questions that an asthmatic needs to go through each year about how they're managing with their asthma, is it going okay, and turn that into a survey just via a link that the patient could do. So around then, we'd basically just started turning that on for sort of every practice in the country, basically, and allowing them to like manage their asthmatics remotely where possible. And that was starting to go in some sense of a sort of very, very early concept of a practice inbox where they could manage all these responses that come in from their asthmatic patients.
Okay, so that is all, you know, pre-2020.
Yeah, exactly.
Where were you when you first really started thinking about COVID as a potential business problem for you to solve?
I definitely remember around sort of February time having some chats internally about it. And I think we maybe even like did put a sort of thought piece out there, but it still felt very much like one of those things we were just, like a lot of product ideas, you're just sort of talking about. And then I remember incredibly clearly, so we have a team dinner every Thursday of the first Thursday of the month. And we were at a restaurant in London, and sort of like the whole team gathered together. And quite late on in dinner, I remember our investor director, so Arena from Atomico, WhatsApping us an article that Sequoia had written about Black Swan events, and also saying, then afterwards, is there something we should be doing? Should we be helping at least just text information about COVID to patients or something? And so my co-founder Jacob and I had a little chat, and we were like, maybe really should like do something about this. Whatever it was at the time, it really sort of like triggered a bit more with us at that moment. And we thought like, this is something we need to lean into. And so I think on the way home about sort of midnight, Jacob was like firing off some emails to some video providers being like, hey, have you got an API we can use and some details to try out tomorrow? And by the time I got in the next day on the Friday morning, he's already like playing around with a couple of different APIs, and he'd got that glint in his eye, which he's very much a product person that he often does, of like, I've basically got an idea and he wants to see how quickly we can basically do something in the product. And so we decided on that Friday, basically, we want to lean into this. And so we wanted to build video consultations and then also take that exact same survey technology I just talked about and release a COVID triaging survey to support practices actually trying to work out, hey, Dan, have you been to Italy recently? Are you coughing? Should you come to your appointment ultimately?
Got it. And you know, before we do get into it then, because so, your product's taken a couple of pivots. So how do you describe what your product is today? Like, to the layman listening that's never come across you, what is your product? How does it work?
So ultimately, our vision is that everybody involved in the patient's care can communicate with each other. So whilst we're very clinician-focused today, that's really our ultimate aim. Our sort of biggest product offering right now sits in general practice, and really we provide a suite of tools that allow clinicians to communicate with patients and then manage all of those responses. So think of it a bit like a Gmail, but for general practice.
Do you ever describe it as a Slack for X, or have you just been told not to do that?
Yeah, you could think of it very much like a Slack as well. I guess one of our key concepts is almost that we have like each channel is like a patient almost. So all of our communication is very much tied to the concept of a patient. And we believe that sort of patient-centric communication is very much like the way the world's going to go.
Got it. Now, my understanding and my research is you got to about 99% market share, no?
Yes. Yeah, so I think within about, it is pretty rare, definitely not where we thought we'd be, you know, looking back. So I think within about sort of 4 or 6 weeks of us releasing this sort of suite of COVID tools, and yeah, we'd gone up from that sort of 50% point to about 99% of GPs using us.
And you did it without even having to go to school with Boris Johnson and getting all the contracts. Amazing.
That's true, yeah.
And how did you actually handle the surge in users as a business? Like, what did you learn from that huge growth so fast?
We were lucky technically, things held up really well. We, by that time, having got to 50%, we did have a relatively slick self-service or install process and setup process, and you know, surrounding sort of articles. Look, I think, yes, one thing we learned was that having that in place was really good. The other thing we learned was that having an incredible support team and investing in both the hiring and, you know, developing those people really, really pays dividends. Because the tech, obviously, yeah, you can scale up. It's great for me. If, you know, more users come on board, you can maybe give your servers a bit more juice and you're done, hopefully. But our support team were four people and they went from 300 tickets a week to 3,000 tickets a week overnight. And it's not because users were struggling. It's just because everyone was getting in touch saying, how do I do this? You know, can you add this feature to video? Most of it was just interest in the product, but there was no way to really like switch that off. And we wanted to still give an incredible level of customer support and responsiveness. And I think that just paid off like so much. And also the rest of the team rallying around them. So other people doing support shifts. I remember before we, you know, went remote, people pushing massive trolleys of like tea and biscuits over to the support corner because they could barely like leave their desk. And I think they just underpinned like the whole effort for me. And I think that's our front door ultimately, right? Like if people have a problem or need feedback, they contact our support team. And without investing and just having such an amazing team there, we just wouldn't have made it through that time.
That makes sense. And how did like this growth and stuff, how did it actually affect your financials? So I know that you ended up doing, you know, a Series A, for example, but I mean, you know, had you really thought through the business side enough that actually this massive opportunity created huge margins and massive scalable growth? Or is it something that you were caught off guard with and you're still having to figure out a bit?
Yeah, so we'd raised our A about a year before COVID, but because the team was, you know, still relatively small, we were in an okay sort of position financially. I mean, for us, we're a mission-driven company. And so ultimately at that time, what we were thinking about was how can we support the NHS getting through this time? That was like our only you know, aim at that particular moment in time. For us, the video consultations, there was in the end actually a national contract for that. So there was some money that we did get in and some revenue from that thing. But also our text message bill, as you might imagine, which we paid for at the time, also went through the roof. So we also started spending a lot more on that and also things like compute and obviously needed to hire a lot more people. So it actually meant that our burn went up a fair amount, but obviously we still kept a close eye on it. But yeah, we were lucky enough. We did have enough money in the bank. We could lean into those opportunities and were very, very grateful that we could be a part of trying to help, you know, in a small way, at least, the NHS get through a really tough time.
What is the current situation then financially? Where do you see yourselves?
So yeah, now we're in a position where, so a lot of these features that we added during that time, we knew that we couldn't sustain them forever being free features. And so we've grown out our commercial team over the last sort of year or so and have taken some of those features we've added and then built other things sort of on top and now have a sort of Accurex Plus tier, which is broken into sort of five modules. And so we're now in a position where we do make some sustainable revenue from sort of Accurex Plus contracts with clinical commissioning groups who sort of sit above GP practices in the NHS structure.
Good. And Series B?
Yeah, potentially on the cards this year. We're in a position where we don't have to do it immediately, but obviously off the back of both the growth from the work we did in the beginning of COVID and the sort of vaccine work and commercializing the product, we're definitely feeling in a sort of good position, but there's lots more we also want to prove.
If you've got 99% market share, what do you strategically do? Is like, what are your options at this point?
I think for us at the moment, I mean, whilst we're definitely interested in being an international company, and ultimately our vision is definitely cross-border. Every patient and clinician needs to be able to contact each other. We definitely want to go deep here first, and both with our GP product. There's so much more we still feel we can do with the GP product, but also moving outside of GP. So we already do some work with some hospital trusts, and you know, ultimately, we see so much value in being able to connect up those two areas. So, say, primary to secondary care, to district nursing, to pharmacy. You know, we consider ourselves a sort of communication platform. So the more links in the network, the more value we think we can provide. So it definitely feels like even within the NHS, it's still very early days for us.
Next up, you'll find out what it's like to be at the center of the vaccine delivery machine for COVID and how you preserve customer service, culture, and morale when going through explosive growth under the immense pressures of a pandemic. Stay tuned. Business banking can really suck, which is why we've partnered with Revolut Business and are offering you an exclusive deal you can't find anywhere else. Revolut Business is a super easy, powerful, and personalized account. We use it at my own startup, Heights, and for good reason. You can send and receive money at the interbank rate with no hidden fees and open accounts in more than 28 currencies. You can get physical and virtual cards for you and your team so you can track spending, set limits, pay for subscriptions and ad spend, or freeze cards in one tap. But what I like the most is you can integrate with all your apps or plugins like accounting and expenses and manage your finances easily all from one place so you can focus on your actual business goals. We've partnered with Revolut Business to bring you an exclusive 2-month paid plan for free so you can move your business forward. Go to revolut.com/secretleaders to claim your free 2-month trial. That's revolut.com/secretleaders.
Did you know that research suggests nutrition has a big impact on your body's ability to respond to vaccines due to the health of your immune system? Vitamin A, C, D, E, B complex, iron, zinc, omega-3, and selenium have all been shown to have benefits for immunity and your body's response to vaccines. Before you ask, yes, they are all in Heights Smart Supplement, because what's good for your immune system is usually the same as what's crucial for your brain. So, give yourself an immunity boost and feed your brain what it needs to thrive. Head over to yourheights.com and use the code LEADERS to get 10% off today. So how did you actually get involved with the vaccine booking system, and like, how did you build it given that there were no users in theory?
Yeah, so it, in some ways, is a bit of a similar story to COVID round one, where, you know, it became clear that GP practices and primary care networks were going to be involved in the vaccine rollout. And so we started to have conversations internally, we often do. Is this something we want to be involved in? Can we take a product team? Can we afford to take a product team off what they're working on, put them onto this? We even published a blog about the sort of role that we thought software should help play in the vaccine rollout. And like a lot of these things, I think, you know, our company processes were maybe a little bit more in place sort of back end of that year. So we did actually have a proper go, no go meeting on the Friday, the 13th of November, where we gathered a few sort of senior people together and said, do we want to do this? We need to make the decision today, because if we don't basically make the decision today, there's not enough time to build anything. And so for us, that came down to, you know, does this align with our mission? What are some of the second and third order effects on the organization? And have we got a team that can even pull this off? For us, we were happy with sort of each of those three things. And so we went to the team and asked them that we thought, you know, we're going to work on this. Is this something you want to do? It's really important for us that the team are bought into the decision as well. They should have a right to refuse this being thrown on them. And they said, yes, this is something we want to do. And so the Monday following that, so on the 15th, we were already doing whiteboarding sessions of like, what does this solution look like?
Amazing. What do you think people would have done if basically you guys hadn't come along? Like, how would we be booking our vaccines?
So there are some other solutions out there, and there is a separate sort of software solution for the national booking sites. So there are both, you know, mass vaccination sites and then sort of like local vaccinations. And within the sort of GP local vaccinations, there are other providers. I guess, yeah, it's hard to know exactly. We'd like to obviously think that we've had an impact, and in particular, because we've helped book a lot of vaccines sort of self-service via our sort of text messaging and link technology, we'd hope that that saves a large amount of NHS time and helped sort of drive efficiency. I think one of the incredible things about the NHS is they always find a way, no matter what. So I'd never sort of go be as arrogant as to say without us, it wouldn't have still been a success. I think they do always manage to do well. But I certainly hope that we've made an impact and have made it a little bit easier and allowed people to maybe, you know, go home that hour earlier each day when they're trying to get through lots of patients.
Yeah, I mean, I read that a third of vaccine bookings in the UK now happen through your platform. Is that right?
I think it's roughly around that, yeah.
Why do you think there isn't just like one simple booking system for the whole country? Or is that just a stupid question?
No, it's not a stupid question at all. I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, I think the first one, and say it's like no one's ever done this before, right? It's just such like uncharted territory. And actually, the decision, I think, to use GP practices and primary care networks to vaccinate people happened quite late on. I think it was definitely the correct decision. I think it's been really, really effective using them. But I think that did happen sort of late on. So that did mean that the national booking system, I don't think, was going to be sort of used there. And GP practices obviously do already book lots of appointments and sort of and give things like flu jabs out. I mean, ultimately, it's always a bit of a trade-off. I think having multiple systems or two different systems, it can be really good in lots of ways. It's allowed us to focus on our use case and try and make it so that it works really, really well for those use cases. Massvax sites are very different. Up until now, I think they've only given AstraZeneca. They book both jabs at once. Oh, the main problem we've found is that we don't have knowledge of when people do have an appointment at the in like a national booking system. And so patients might receive, for example, like two invitations. So at the pace the program's been rolled out, we haven't all been talking to each other about who's got appointments where. And I mean, that's something we're looking to correct sort of at the moment. But, you know, at the speed the program's rolled out, that was always going to be a slightly secondary concern of if someone gets two invitations, that's a hell of a lot better than getting zero.
Yeah, that's true. So, I mean, is that one of your biggest challenges? Has it been receiving like negative feedback on, like, I guess, some of like the smoothness of the product on the basis of how fast you've had to bring this out? And has that been difficult to deal with, if that's the case?
I think it's definitely the case that it's the quickest we've ever had to roll out an incredibly complex product. You know, you look back to the beginning of COVID when we added video consultations in a weekend. May sound really impressive, but we had so much infrastructure we could already sort of build on top of. It actually was really a sort of increment there. Whereas this was just like something completely from scratch. I mean, we had the ability to send text messages, you know, in bulk and lots of other things, but we really were starting from scratch. And as you mentioned earlier on, no one even knew what this product should look like or do yet. And the sort of backdrop of the vaccine program is constantly changing, right? You know, December time, we moved from 3 to 4 weeks to 11 to 12 weeks between doses, and definitely the right decision, but means your software's got to change each time that happens. And so I think we've definitely felt both, at times people getting frustrated with the software, because when you try and automate things, it then means sometimes people can't do things in the way they want. And we've also tried to build it in such a way that it works for like most people, but that also mostly means that then it quite often doesn't fit each person's use case. You know, you're trying to sort of be this wedge in the middle that just about works for everyone, which means it sort of doesn't really work perfectly for anyone. And that's like a massive product trade-off. And, you know, we've been stressed during this period building it. The NHS News have been really stressed trying to deliver the vaccine as well. And we've definitely, I think it would be fair to say, both felt each other's stress in that. It's definitely been harder for the team, I think, this time around than, say, last March when things really accelerated. And it's a lot of the criticism has been fair as well, right? Like when users get in touch and say, this isn't working for me, they're not saying it unfairly either. And often the feedback's really useful. And so part of our role is just to try and remain calm, like collect that feedback and work out what our next best step is.
Does that affect morale when you're getting sort of irritated feedback like that though?
It definitely has. Like I think what's been difficult is that we're very, very like user research led company, and we love spending time on the front line with users. And, you know, one of the things we used to do pre-COVID is go out to GP practices really, really regularly. And I think the sort of emotional connection you get from watching someone use something that you've built in person gives you like this massive energy boost where you go back to the, you know, Accurex HQ and you're like, I can't wait to fix some of these problems, help that person out. And we've just not had that over the last few months. So, you know, for both our users and for us, a lot of the sort of like connections through WhatsApp or Facebook or our sort of online support chat. And so it's easy to forget that there's another person at the other end of that who might have built the software, or for us that they're trying to get home and your software's just not working for them and they're going to be like stressed out. And I think that's actually the biggest thing I found, that it's hard to keep that energy going and to see firsthand the impact you're having, because yeah, there are going to be people getting in touch saying it doesn't work for them, but it's easy to forget. There are loads of people every single day who are booking completely seamlessly, and that's providing an incredible service and really easy during, you know, lockdown and you're not seeing your friends, getting break to focus on those things ultimately.
Yeah. What has been your biggest challenge as you've like scaled the company over the last year?
You know, if we sort of look back over the last year, the first challenge was the sort of hiring remotely one for us, something we hadn't done. Obviously, going from 50 to 99% of GPs, we were sort of overstretched as a team, and we were only 25 people and then supporting a huge number of GP practices. So I think that was very much our first challenge to go through over sort of summer last year. I think the last few months with the vaccine program, it's much more been sort of around burnout and balance of the team. You know, one of our company values is balance. And for us, that's always meant if people are like happy and healthy, both inside and outside of work, they can do their best work. And that we should have a good sort of balance between sprints where we need to get something over the line and then making sure people can recover from that. And this has been a sprint for many, many months, basically. And that is just unsustainable for people. It's unsustainable for the team working on it, for the senior leadership, for myself and my co-founder. You know, eventually that has a really big impact on you, especially when you haven't got some of those other, you know, joys in life of going to the gym or seeing your friends at the restaurant to go to. So that has been a huge, huge challenge for us. And it's been particularly difficult because it's not really a pressure that we have artificially like created. So we also can't artificially back off it, right? You know, if the vaccine program does change or we need to adapt our software or more people sign up to use the vaccine booking software, it's very, very hard to like say no to that or turn away from it, right? So that's just been really, really tricky. And I've definitely both felt, you know, both the pressure myself and then felt awful for almost having put like the team through it in a sense. And sort of, I guess when we asked them to go back to what I said, when we asked them, do you want to work on this? I don't think any of us quite realized the Herculean effort that would be required over such a long time to actually deliver it.
How do you reconcile emotionally with this concept of like one of your guiding values is balance, but actually the reality, you know, the intention of saying that, but the reality is so different. So you're essentially running a company that is fundamentally every day operating the opposite way of one of your own values. That must be difficult as a founder to reconcile and must be hard culturally for the team.
Yeah, it's been really, really tough. And one of our other values is being mission driven. So you've also sort of got one of your values you're almost trying to live out to the full, which has meant you've started to betray this other value. And yeah, I think culturally it becomes very worrying. You know, you start to worry, are people going to get to the end of this period? And then are they going to leave and say, well, it was cool what we did, but I just can't do that again. For new joiners in particular, started to really worry that they think this is our sort of standard way of operating. And you're trying to say, hey, this is different to usual. I think ultimately what we've always tried to do is get to a point of just calling a spade. And so I think the best thing to do is try and be transparent about it and say, we have betrayed one of our values here and we are really sorry about this and it is not going to be forever. And we did used to operate differently as a company, and try and give almost permission as much as possible to other people to then call you out if that shift does not occur. We also use an employee engagement tool called Peakon to sort of survey people every week about how they're feeling. So that's something, you know, at a senior leadership level, we take really seriously about people's responses to that. And some of it is around workload. But yeah, I think it's got to be honesty. You can't, people know, as you said, you're operating basically against one of the things you've put up on the wall. And to basically not just call it out is going to make this massive elephant in the room.
What's been your biggest challenge over the last couple of years?
I mean, other than sort of very much on like a personal level, like the last few months and sort of working so hard, some of our biggest challenges have been probably like pre-Series A, like getting someone to like believe in us and, you know, say like, hey, this is something special. I guess there was a year when we were growing loads and like people, lots of GPs seemed to be signing up, but it still seemed really hard to get someone to like back us. I guess like healthcare, yeah, it's sometimes like a tricky space, right? And so that was really, really hard. And it took a really long time for us to eventually like get our financing round over the line. And that was a really hard sort of sustained challenge. I think the other big challenge that companies will always face, right, that is continually trying to hire fast but not break your culture. And that's something that is an everlasting challenge that we think about all the time and is really, really at front of center of our minds right now because we're going through quite a lot of hiring. As I mentioned, we're 80 now. I think we're probably going to be around 150 or more by the end of the year. And so how you keep doing that and, you know, telling stories and trying to pass on some of that organizational memory to new starters of like, why are we here? What are the decisions we've made? You know, how do you try and go about product decisions? Have you talked to a user? Those things, I think, have always been a challenge and will continue to be one. Like, how do you protocolize those and pass those lessons on?
What about at home?
I mean, I think really the big challenge for me has pretty much been over the last few months there. Like, in general, I did find that maybe because one of our company values was balance, that actually, even though I was a founder, I did manage to, I felt, have the right balance for me most of the time between Accurex and home. Always, you know, always tried to make sure I did the things that I guess were important to me and made me feel like me. So whether that was going out for a couple of runs a week, seeing my friends for, like, at the weekend at the pub, but definitely during the pandemic in general, and then over the last few months, that swung completely, you know, out of kilter. And pretty much every single night, I must have been horrible for my partner because I was just basically completely absent. Even if you're in the room, you're sort of absent, right? Because you're constantly checking Slack or going back to work. And I was very lucky that she both put up with me and, you know, helped, like, feed me and do some of our washing and things like that. That was really, really tough. You know, you're sort of like in that situation, but it also feels very, very hard to know sort of what to do. And I felt such a great responsibility to both her, but then also to, like, the team and our mission. And I find it very hard, it's particular if, like, a user's getting in touch on Twitter at like 9 p.m. like, can you help me? I find it almost impossible to ignore that. So I found that sort of switching off element and, like, giving enough time to being with her really, really tricky.
Yeah, I mean, I relate to this a lot. And it's kind of why I was asking. And I think a lot of people listening that have experienced co-living in the pandemic and actually, you know, having either survive their business, if it's not thriving, and how to deal with that. And that 9 p.m. tweet that comes in when you're a business that, you know, needs that customer, or you're at breaking point because you're growing so fast and you need to make sure that that customer is satisfied. You know, I'm just curious how your relationship behind the company had developed over the last period. But I know that you're going on holiday next week, so you're finally getting some respite away from it all.
Yes. Yeah. That will be nice to switch off, and definitely owe it to my partner to try and actually mute Slack for at least some hours of the day so that I'm not, like, distracted by it all. I'm also lucky that I think we, outside of just my partner, had like a strong support network at work, and we, you know, we put a lot of time into building our sort of senior leadership trust levels over the last year. And so, you know, we do a temperature check at the beginning of every senior leadership meeting, and there, it's very, very useful to be able to openly, in front of other people, have your sort of your thumb pointing towards down and be like, I'm not super right now. I am pretty stressed and I'm pretty burnt out. And I think that helps a lot, knowing that you've got those people around you and they'll say, that's all right.
Yeah, it makes sense. So what's next for Accurex then?
For us this year, a big part of it will be, now we've commercialized that GP product, not at all letting it sit there and making it even better. And, you know, using the money we're lucky enough to have been given through, you know, NHS CCGs to make the product fantastic, and then investing in outside of primary care. So, you know, really, really keen to work out what bits of our product can be really useful to people in pharmacies, district nursing, hospitals, and lots of different use cases there. And ultimately, you know, our dream would be to then start to connect them up to primary care. We're all, you know, very familiar with sort of letters going between different parts of the healthcare system. We'd love to try and make some of that a little bit slicker this year.
Yeah, I mean, I read online that, you know, one of your biggest criticisms, which, you know, isn't at you really, but just the way that it's happened, is just the lack of competition, right? You've got 99% market share.
So, yeah, I think for us, we'd always see competition as a healthy thing. It's really good to make sure that we continue to try and provide really good software for, you know, people in the NHS, and that they get the best software for ultimately the taxpayers' money that's, like, going there. And we you know, want to stay on our toes, and we need to keep like improving the product ultimately. So I think for us, we believe more the former, that the competition is going to be really healthy, and we're a big believer in let users be choosers. So ultimately, we always feel that there should be budget there for IT in the health system, and that budget should be ideally as devolved as possible, so that you as someone who runs a general practice can say, I want to choose AccurX, or if you're not finding it up scratch, you can try something else. And then, you know, ideally that switching costs should be low enough that you can switch and come back, for example, as well. So I think we would hope it'd always be more of the former, that users should be in control, and then the responsibility solely lies on us to keep producing fantastic software, to go and stay true to our roots, ultimately, go and speak to users, see what they're doing, what are their user needs, what are their pain points. And I'm a big believer, if we keep doing that, like what's got us here, then I hope we can stay, you know, close to that 99%. And if we're slipping from that, it probably means we're doing something different to what got us here.
Love it. Thank you so much, mate. It's been a massive pleasure.
Thanks, Dan. It's been really, really good to chat.
Next week on Secret Leaders.
The taxi situation in Tallinn was just horrible. They wouldn't show up on time, their quality was poor, the prices were high. I literally spent the next 4 months going to the taxi stands in Tallinn and trying to sign up the drivers one by one. You're stuck to this one taxi company, you need to pay them a monthly fee, they don't guarantee you any income, but what if you would have a no-risk proposition? You could just download this app, you only pay if you actually get any rides, to which 90% of them immediately said, get the fuck out of my car.
Next week, we've got one of Europe's youngest unicorn founders on the show as the Uber competitor Bolt joins us in the studio to talk about how their surprising and meteoric rise has gone so far. Tune in or you'll miss out.
If you're enjoying our show and you're happy to help us, please can you get out your phone right now and rate us on your favorite podcast player, because that's the stuff that actually makes a difference. Thanks so much. This episode was hosted by me, Dan Murray-Serta. It was produced by Rich Martel, with editing done by Lower Street Media.